thanks to everybody for coming. I'm Rob Davis, reporter with Voice of San Diego, and appreciate everybody being here. I'll introduce everybody in a second, but I kind of wanted to set the stage for this afternoon's discussion. There's a New York Times story about a week ago that warned that the day of reckoning is close on the Colorado River and in the Southwest as the levels in Lake Mead drop. In San Diego, where I live, there's been an active and passionate discussion about new water supplies and politicking on both sides of them, recycling sewage, desalinating seawater, even trading water rights with Mexico so that desalination plants can be built there without as much regulatory fight. And really throughout the West and throughout the country, whether you're in Georgia or at the end of the Colorado River, the idea of shortage is really becoming a new normal and a way of life. And at the same time, we dump partially treated sewage in our waters. Point sources have been dealt with somewhat through the Clean Water Act, but non-point sources are now emerging as sort of the new target. And that's our soundtrack. So what's there to write about? I wanted to give everybody just a few instant story ideas because I promised them for anybody who came, and then we'll get to our discussion. Go home and call your city and ask them about water loss. Ask them how much water the municipal system loses. The American Water Works Association says an average is around 8 or 10%. This is water that your city buys, it pays for, and then it disappears in the system. And I can guarantee you that in some older cities, the situation is much worse than in San Diego, which is about average. San Diego's in the funny position of actually, if they invested that money in water meters so they didn't lose the money and actually billed people for it, they would be better off, but they don't make the investment. If you live in California or in states with good open records laws, public officials' water use is public record. And we had a councilman who used 1 million gallons a year at the same time he was telling everybody else to save every drop. So there are fun possibilities there as well. So introduce our first speaker, Michelle Bryan Mudge. She's an assistant professor at the School of Law at the University of Montana. Water rights is part of her expertise, and she's here to give us a little bit of an introduction to the issue and to tell us as reporters what we need to know if we're covering water in our communities.
Thank you, Rob. And for those of you that were at my and Steve Brown's session earlier in the week, I'm promising not to duplicate what I said before. So what I want to do is sort of set a framework for where the West has been with water law, where the West is going with water law, and what I see as some of the big stories. And I think from there we're going to delve more deeply into some of those story possibilities. So to begin with, we have to understand that traditionally water has been the province of state law. And the function of Western water law traditionally was to allocate water among competing uses. The reason it went to court was because there was fight over whose it was and how they got to use it. So we have to think that the original purpose of water law was to help resolve fights between competing users and to create a legal system that allowed us to further the public policy of settling the West. To settle the West, we needed to be able to move water to places that it wasn't necessarily located in order to make the land productive. So there was a very utilitarian rationale for Western water law to make the rules predictable to allow human development of land. We can think of one example as the Central Arizona Project. Think about all the vast quantities of water transecting the desert to get to a beautiful desert oasis, right? And we live in the beautiful desert oasis of Phoenix. Right, so that's really the epitome of the goal of Western water law, to make it habitable for all of us and to encourage settlement and investment. So if people invest in projects like that, moving water to other places, they have to be secure in their investment. And so what Western water law said is we're going to create a system called prior appropriation. First in time, first in right. The first person there who diverted the water and put it to use was entitled to a priority date. They got to use that full amount before any secondary junior users could take any at all. The other point then was that it had to be utilitarian, it had to be beneficially used. If you weren't beneficially using it, you lost it. The next person who was there in line waiting to beneficially use it for society's productivity could take it from there. So what we were looking at then was this idea actually that the utilitarian use of water was more important than habitat. Habitat really wasn't part of the equation. So you could take all of the water, you could dewater the water course, and that was societally allowed, permitted, even encouraged. And not only could you take all the water, you could take it somewhere else, away from the community where it originated. Out-of-basin transport was an upheld principle. Very different, by the way, than the East, where water rights were attached to the land along the water. Some states in the West mix these two doctrines together. States like California, Oregon, Washington. But if you go down the Rocky Mountain spine, where pure prior appropriation, where purest, we followed the lead of Colorado that said riparianism does not work in the West. Great inefficiencies are tolerated under this prior appropriative doctrine, so that it is not uncommon to uphold losses of water, Rob just mentioned losses, of 50% to 75% along the way of transporting the water to get it where it needs to be used. And one of the famous cases is a case out of Nebraska called Carey versus Cochran. It came out in the 1940s, and it said if you can even get a trickle of water to that senior user at the end of the river, you have to get the trickle of water to them because they have the priority date. And in that case, they were looking at taking 700 cubic feet per second of water to deliver 162 CFS to the senior user. And they said, if any amount of that 162 can get there, we will run it through, even though most of it is being lost along the way. So that's sort of a quintessential representation, I think, of the philosophy of the West use of water. So today we're struggling with these traditional principles. And if you've read Crossing the Next Meridian by Charles Wilkinson, he calls them these principles the lords of yesterday. They're still ruling us today. And we have to figure out how to make them work, how to adapt them to a new set of values, where we see water as a natural heritage that provides ecosystem services, recreation, and aesthetics alongside all of the traditional utilitarian purposes. For this reason and many others, we have states stepping in and creating modern permitting systems so that new water uses are analyzed in light of a lot of different social values, including public interests like ecosystem services and habitat. Not every state does that. Montana's one that does, where we just take a whole hard look at is water available? Yes, you can have it for any beneficial use. We don't factor in public interest here, but a lot of other states now do. We also then deal with the emerging federal environmental law and how it intersects with the traditional realm of state water law, recognizing that the two have to work together, and that's where a lot of the writing story, I think the writing topics come up today, as well as places that are sort of moving beyond the law, because it's a slow-moving machine, right? Places that are moving beyond the law and creating by contract or other agreements alternatives to the status quo under the law. And hopefully I'll have time to talk about a couple examples of that, one right here in our own backyard. So what I see as the emerging areas, a big one is the endangered species and how its protection affects traditional water rights, as I mentioned. Under the prior appropriation system, you can dewater, you can transport out of basin. How does that work with endangered species protection? Whether it's on a federal project or even a private water project. And another question would be combining that with climate change, where we're talking a lot about the harms of low flow that are going to be caused by climate variability. How do we deal with the fact that the law allows dewatering? And if we're encouraged to do more storage to even out water flows under climate variability, how do we reconcile that with our endangered species protection? If we're called to do alternative energy and build hydropower facilities, how do we do that and protect our endangered species? To the extent the government steps in and says, on these old water rights, sorry, you can't use them anymore because of endangered species or other habitat concerns, do we have takings? Can we afford to pay people for all of these rights that have been developed that they needed in order to settle the West, which the government wanted them to do? It gets very confusing. I think Laura's going to talk about groundwater and surface water, but that's definitely where a lot of stories are. Along with that, this idea of two separate universes of law, land use on the one hand, water law on the other, why aren't they working together? Why are cities zoning areas for development that have no water supply near them, for example? The role of the federal right, water rights, including tribal reserve rights, tribal aboriginal rights, and the water rights held on federal land holdings. Is that an area where we can address some of these critical issues? The role of the public trust doctrine, particularly in states like California and Hawaii that have expanded it to include the health of the water habitat. I think Tom's going to talk about the Clean Water Act. There's a lot of issues there. The other one I had on my list was interstate water disputes, where one example being the Snake Valley Aquifer in Vegas versus Utah, and the fact that there is no water law to decide interstate water disputes. They go to the Montana, or the, that'd be fun if they went to the Montana Supreme Court. If they go to the U.S. Supreme Court, who decides them really on a case-by-case basis. So those are some very interesting ideas, I think, and a lot to be explored there.
Do you want to riff on the state permitting issue? Do you want to continue on?
I don't know reporter lingo. On the permitting. Elaborate on it a little bit more, you bet. So to elaborate on this transition to modern day permitting, in the wild, wild west, before there were courts, before there were agencies, before there were even states, this prior appropriation doctrine was born. It was born, people attributed to rules that the miners developed in the mining camps in the same way that they would stake their mining claim. I got here first, it's mine. That's how they arrived at the principle of prior appropriation, first in time, first in right. But at some point, there were so many people claiming so much water that there were more rights claimed than water available. And at that point, states had come on the scene and they wanted to shift over to a system where people filed their water right like civilized human beings and said, this is my water right, this is the day I developed it, so that there was a record and people could reconcile who held what rights. And from there, when we had the environmental era, the agencies sort of emerged that said, we're actually going to start reviewing water rights and deciding whether someone can have one, instead of it being a self-initiated process where you went out and just started using water. Now you went to an agency and the agency analyzed how many rights were claimed, was there water available still for new users to come on, and the criteria that the agencies have applied has evolved over time to include new things. Will old users be harmed, for example? So is there going to be an adverse impact to any of the old rights? And some states now have added environmental considerations or preferences. We're going to encourage domestic rights over industrial rights, for example. So the agencies, if they got two competing applications, would give preference to one over another. And public interest. What are the needs of the state as a whole, and would granting this permit further those needs? So now we have factored in a lot of other values, but that doesn't unravel the old rights. The old rights still exist. So the new permitted rights that come online are going to be necessarily junior in time. Colorado is the only state that doesn't do it by agency. They do it by a court. The court takes all that evidence.
So we've seen this in California, where we have drained the Sacramento Delta to provide water that the Colorado River used to. And there has been a very clear push in the last 3 years to provide water for the environment, provide water for fish. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about sort of the implications of that against somebody who has rights to that water.
So an emerging issue then is these old rights that have long been used for some utilitarian purpose. How do they survive a new regulatory scheme like the Endangered Species Act? So maybe a little bit about the Endangered Species Act. It applies more broadly than a lot of the other environmental acts in that it applies both to federal agency actions, federally funded projects, but also to private actors as well. And so under that act, you can't do anything that would be likely to jeopardize the continued existence of an endangered species or adversely modify its habitat. And there have been decisions that have come down saying that diversion works that carry water qualify as things that would modify habitat. Very different than what you think of under the Clean Water Act. There's pretty broad exemptions for agricultural diversion and agricultural runoff. Endangered Species Act can apply to irrigation works. And we have a case that came out of California in 92 called Glen Calusa on the Sacramento River, where there was a federal, this was a federal project to produce hydropower, and the Endangered Species Act was applied to a storage facility. And got a bunch of different cases on here. There's another one where it was applied to diversion works called Riverside Irrigation District. And that was on the South Platte, coming out of Colorado. And it's also been applied in a case called the Casitas Municipal Water District. Part of the Glen Calusa case was a faulty, it started out not even having a fish screen, and they had to modify their diversion works to incorporate a fish screen, and then it was found that the fish screen was deficient, and the district was enjoined from diverting and delivering water until they brought it up to snuff. The reason the Endangered Species Act is so significant is that it has a section that applies to these private users. And it says if you even harass, it sort of applies to harass, harm, pursue, hunch, shoot, kill, trap, capture, collect. It's this really broad list of things. And obviously, if you are running a facility that fish used to swim up and spawn, and you prevent them from traveling up, you're going to be trapping them, not allowing them to reach their spawning grounds, and thus you're triggering this take provision. And you either have to get an incidental take permit that shows you aren't harming them to a significant degree, or you have to completely modify your diversion works. So that's one issue, is that it could affect the design of the diversion, whether it's a public project or a private project. The next issue then is on a federal project where the federal government has contracted to deliver water to users, and they decide they can't do that anymore because that delivery of water would endanger an endangered species. It would put them at risk or their habitat at risk. And in those situations, we get into this question of, have the users suffered a property taking? And it's a really fascinating question. It's one that is still being refined within the court system. And a lot of these cases go to the federal court of claims because it's claimed as a taking and people are seeking reimbursement. But we saw these claims in the famous incident in the Klamath where water was not delivered. We had these types of claims made. The other type of claim happened in the Casitas Municipal Water District case where the federal project actually took some water out of the project, diverted it over a fish ladder, and the water ended up in the river instead of being delivered to the users. And in that case, the court said, we find a taking because you physically picked up the water and moved it somewhere else. But in the Klamath Irrigation District case, the court looked at it very differently and said, this is not a physical taking, it's just a breach of contract case where they didn't honor their contractual obligation, and they found that the government can get out of its contract if it has some overriding sovereignty reason, like a legal obligation under the Endangered Species Act. The other really interesting piece about the Klamath was that they had a second overriding sovereignty obligation, which was to the tribes. I mentioned this idea of tribal Aboriginal rights. They operate outside of state law. They date to time immemorial, and they arise under a treaty which says the tribes retain their right to traditional fishing. And in those instances, the courts have found, well, in order to honor an Aboriginal right, there has to be sufficient water to continue providing that right. And so the federal government had an Endangered Species Act and a treaty obligation that they were arguing under to get out of their contract. Did that help?
Yeah. And in the Casitas case, the government is actually reimbursing the water district for the water that it is taking, actually writing the check.
So in the Casitas case, where a taking was found, I believe the parties could have run that up the ladder and appealed it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And because right now we have a disagreement among the lower federal courts as to whether the non-delivery of water can be a taking. Some are saying yes, some are saying no, and it hasn't gotten to the U.S. Supreme Court yet. They're trying to figure out how to take property law cases and apply them to water. There are arguments like the water's temporarily not being delivered, but it will be delivered again in the future when there's enough. And others are saying, but they'll never get that back patch of water ever. That was forever taken. And so my understanding in that case is instead of running it up to the U.S. Supreme Court, they settled it. They went ahead and agreed to pay. But I don't know that the federal government is in a position to do that over and over again in the future. One of the other really fascinating things about that case is that the state argued a defense called background principles of state law. It comes out of the Lucas versus South Carolina Coastal Commission case, which is a really famous environmental land use case where Mr. Lucas wasn't allowed to build on the beach. And the court said, if you take away all economically viable use of a piece of property, you have to pay for it under a regulatory action. Except if under state law, you never could have done that anyway. Like, pretend it would have been, pretend he had proposed a nuisance, like building some sort of dangerous facility right there under state law. He wouldn't have been allowed to do it anyway, so there really is no taking. Does that make sense? So that was argued in the Casitas case, that under the Public Trust of California, which protects habitat, you can't do things like that anyway. But we don't know where that argument will go in the future. But it was an interesting argument. I think the same lawyer that argued it in the Mono Lake decision, which was a very successful public trust decision from the perspective of the environment, he argued it in the Casitas case.
Let me pose this last question to you and sort of provide a segue into Laura Lundquist, who's a reporter from the Twin Falls Times News. But really, I've seen it across the country in Lubbock, Texas, where we're going to have a conference in a couple of years. There is an aquifer that is being drawn down and with sort of no end in sight in California, Arizona, Nevada, we're drawing Lake Mead down with no real plan B to it. So in these sorts of circumstances where cities, states are marching toward shortage, how will rights govern the oversubscribed and the overpromised? Can you have a right to something that doesn't exist?
That's a very good question. So under the let me invent a new doctrine that will illustrate the point. Little guy gets screwed doctrine. Junior guy gets screwed doctrine. Under the prior appropriation system, the first user can take whatever's there. The next user then gets what's left, and so on and so forth. So it's quite expected, even under prior appropriation, that in times of shortage, the junior users get nothing. And that's very different than in the riparian system of the East, which is a shared shortage approach. And I mentioned earlier, so maybe you'll give me a chance to circle back, but that is the impetus for some of these community agreements in the West, to propose an alternative model where people are sharing shortage so that everybody still gets something, including the fish. But if you have like a community like Vegas who knows that they have shortage and they have to go out and get more, then you see these really aggressive, if you read Cadillac Desert, that's what basically the whole book is about, these very aggressive political and financial moves. And it becomes the powerful that get the water because they figure out who has the best rights, they get them, they figure out where the water hasn't been developed yet, they move it where they need it. Yeah.
So, Laura Lundquist, I'll ask you this question. You've seen these shortages manifest themselves in some of the communities that you've covered, and I'm curious how cities in Montana and Idaho are handling sort of the challenge of not having enough water?
Well, cities in Montana aren't handling it very well. There's a couple, yeah, everybody thinks of, when they think of cities that are suffering water shortage, they think of Las Vegas, these large cities. But because of water rights, there are kind of artificial, somewhat, or at least legal shortages being imposed because, and rightly so, a lot of these basins are, and I've got this from water rights lawyers, probably overclaimed. And so if everybody were to take their right at the time, particularly if there's shortages, we just got done hearing that it's going to be a more arid place in the next 50 years, a lot less water falling in some places, temperatures rising, there's not going to be any water left in the rivers. Well, that also applies to underground. So there just happens to be a little community over in the Swan Valley called Sealy Lake that has no water. They have water to use for right now, but they can no longer grow because their water right doesn't allow them to grow anymore for the number of lots that are already committed. And they just found this out recently because they're in a closed basin. That means that no more water rights are being issued either on the surface or on the ground. And that's the thing that a lot of people forget, is that groundwater is interconnected, and that was just finally acknowledged here in Montana in 2006. It was a little bit earlier in Washington, but they call it conjunctive, where groundwater and surface water are connected, and you kind of affects the other. So the city manager there, if you're feeling a little bit lost in everything that you just heard, imagine what a city water manager who doesn't have water rights background gets into when he is tasked with finding water for his community and there's none left in his area, in his watershed. It's all been either claimed and then they're not issuing anymore. It becomes difficult because one of the things that he tried to do was he tried to see if he could lease an irrigation right from one of the landowners. The interesting thing about the Sealy is it's also a watershed that has bull trout in it. And bull trout are a really popular thing in Montana, threatened. And so you had Trout Unlimited over there who were politicking these same landowners for to be able to lease their water also. And that comes to another thing that's starting to happen now, is the price of water rights is skyrocketing. There's no real auction or anything goes on, so you can't really put a price on it. But over in Bozeman, where they're having some problems over there, you're going for $7 million for 100 acre feet or something. I mean, it's just going out of control because they're limited. So whoever has water right now, if cities are looking for water, sky's the limit, And cities can't pay for these things. Over in Bozeman, they can play a little bit more because they have a few more dollars maybe over there. But that's where it goes to, is it's going to go to the people that we're covering. They're going to end up paying for this if it's the water company that's doing this. Sealy Lake couldn't pay for that. They're 2,000 people. So he had to go back and forth through a number of attempts, and as was alluded to here, a couple other states have a thing called the Growing Communities Doctrine, which allows municipalities to have a little bit more priority when it comes to water, but Montana is wholly on the prior appropriation, so they're stuck. Right now they have vetoed any subdivision that comes along that wants to connect to city water, which causes another problem. And that's why I say Montana cities aren't responding very well to it, because in Montana, you don't need a permit to dig a domestic well. So if you want to live in Montana, you just buy your lot. You have to go through an application process if you're gonna have septic on it and things like that. But it's pretty easy, just drill your well, put your septic in, and there's your lot. So growth can still continue, but the limitation of that is every single lot has to be 1 acre, because you don't want these septic effluents going into somebody else's well. I've been told by DEQ, Montana Department of Environmental Quality, that's a pretty arbitrary size for these, what they think is going to clean. And it depends on the aquifer. The reason Sealy is so limited is it's in this glacial valley that has a very limited aquifer. The Eastern Snake River Plain, it's huge, a lot of water. And places like that, places like Missoula, places like Ravalli County that have these great aquifers, are a little bit blind, I think, because they don't run up against the problem as soon as these other communities. Right now there's a community out in eastern Montana, because of the hotter summers that have been happening over the past decade, they go dry every summer. Their wells do. Fairfield, Montana, not every summer, but the real hot, they've gone dry. So these are the problems that cities are running into. Montana is discussing maybe trying to come up with a water market where they can buy and store rights. But with the definition of water rights as it is in Montana, only cities can have rights that they aren't using. You have to use it or you lose it. And so water marketing kind of falls in this weird area that doesn't really covered by water rights, so that's kind of causing that problem. And so, yeah, drilling these wells, the big problem with that is down in Ravalli County, we have an area that has the highest concentration of single family domestic wells. They got 16,000 in just the county. It's like a little pincushion going through all this area. And but what is that? It goes into sprawl, urban sprawl, because everybody's got to have at least 1 acre for all of that. And it's starting to show, not so much because, like I say, they have a really nice aquifer, but it's starting to show in water shortages there. Some of the upper valley areas, they're having to drill lower and lower, and that's what they're finding in this Eastern Snake River Plain, where they've got a lot of irrigation pulling water out of the ground. The aquifers are dropping. San Joaquin Valley, Sacramento Valley, the aquifers are dropping. Everybody thinks groundwater. All I have to do is drill a well, I'll find water. It's not. It's starting to go away. And that also affects the rivers, because the water does come back and refeed the rivers from the bottom sometimes. So it's all interconnected.
In communities that are increasingly relying on wells, and in other communities, what problem does the mix of septic systems and well water pose, and how can we find out about, you know, to where do you turn to find out about the quality of water that is coming out of the tap and where the pollutants are coming from?
Okay, here's a reason for why you should be on city water. They obviously have very good analyses and ways of treating water. But if you have a domestic well, the way to find out is if you have nitrates. Nitrates are indicators of sewage effluent. Problem with that is down in the Ravalli Valley County is sometimes nitrates are natural. The geology contributes nitrates. But if you're seeing an increase, you know, it's more than likely, and then the thing with groundwater, just like river water, it flows down. So if you're on the upper levels of a valley, you're probably doing pretty good. But by the time you get down by the river, you've got all those 1 acre of effluent eventually kind of building up, and everybody thinks that, you know, the ground will just strain indefinitely. But it's like any filter. You know, you put enough burden on it, eventually that stuff can kind of start working its way through. And then I went to a lady's question earlier this morning about zoning down in Ravalli County. They just had a deal where the problem with septic tanks is you got to scrape out the sludge that's in the bottom. It collects, and you got to do something with it. And what they were going to do down in the valley was have a field where they spread the sludge out. This is a way of dealing with septic sludge, and you rotate it under, and so it's kind of like compost. But not everybody just goes to the bathroom in their septic tank, and other things get poured down there. So there's a lot of people that are protesting sludge management systems because other things getting to the groundwater. And when you've got this big field that's full of all the sludge, it's going to affect the downstream wells. But because there's no zoning, they have no recourse, and DEQ is giving it a thumbs up.
How do you find out what is in that groundwater as a reporter?
There's a number of different agencies. Probably a lot of people will have their wells tested, and that's done by the county health departments. There's also a number of agencies that keep track of of wells. USGS, you can go onto their site. There's a number of wells that they monitor in Montana. They've just started this really good monitoring program through the Bureau of Mines, where they're starting to keep track. But these are just sample wells, so there's a lot of missing information in between. So, unless there's a proven problem, a lot of times the EPA isn't there. You're kind of, it's buyer beware, I guess, when you're out there. You might want to just have your well tested. As a reporter, you just have to go to some of the places that sample wells, like USGS or DEQ, have some sample wells, and just see if you can find information out about that.
It gets at one of the, and the EPA maintains a database of drinking water tests and public systems that is certainly worth staying in touch with to find out, what kind of problems. Oftentimes, we found this in San Diego, small communities that have a shared water system have no money to spend on the improvements that are needed to upgrade the system. So if they've got nitrates in their water and they need to spend tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to do it, there's nobody to build that to. And so these issues tend to drag out. I mean, another interesting point, which is the cost of water. This is emerging in California. The price of water in San Diego has gone up about 75% since 2006. And so no matter where you are, being aware of what your water utility is charging for rates is a gold mine for stories, because if they're charging more for water and yet they're spending their own budgeted stuff on ludicrous things, that's a gold mine. So talking about pollution, and I wanted to shift to Tom Henry, who's an environmental writer and columnist from the Toledo Blade, who as a reporter has the fortune to live in a place that has pollution to write about.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm curious to know, Tom, how we can figure out who's dumping crap in our water.
Well, that's a good point, Rob. First, I wanted to just remind people, even though we all probably know water is a big issue, you might be amused by this a little bit. We had a readership survey about 10 years ago, even in the water-rich Great Lakes area in Toledo. And, the result of it basically was that our readers wanted football, and more football. But right after that, surprisingly, water was one of the top issues as far as the news topic that people wanted. I think it ranked higher than any other environmental topic. So there is, even though it can seem sometimes like a mundane issue, I didn't say dry, but a mundane issue. I mean, keep in mind, there are people, there are lively stories out there. It's a contentious issue, certainly out west here, and as it is, and it's getting to be in the Great Lakes area. We're behind you guys in terms of the nastiness of politics of water, but we're learning. But anyways, the question is basically, how do you cover water pollution? I think you need to come into it with kind of a holistic view. I think you need to step back, think of the water body you're looking at, and for me, I normally look at lakes and the Great Lakes and the tributaries that feed into them, and the groundwater that feed the tributaries, and the ankle bone connected to the knee bone and stuff like that. But think of your water body as a living, breathing thing. Think about how it's been used and abused over the years. Learn a little bit of the history of it. Pretend you're going to write a personality story about it. I mean, how would you describe how it's been treated? How people have either managed it for various uses, for boating, recreation, for industry, and so forth. And I think you need to recognize the need to gather information will come from a variety of pathways, and that each piece has its pros and cons. And I'll get to that. I'll get to that more in just a minute. Also, know what kind of have a good idea of what you're looking for. If you're trying to explain a pollution story, is your story more about lead, about phosphorus, mercury, PCBs, acid rain, the bacteria, sewage spills, and also remember, it's not just chemical pollution that we look at, because a lot of pollution that affects waterways affects fish and you know, makes algae grow and like that can be or it can be things like algae that rob oxygen from the water, and taking oxygen from water is essentially taking life from the water for all the uses of it. So you want to look at primarily, and most people know, you want to look at point sources and non-point sources. And the point sources, just a refresher for a lot of people if you're not familiar with these terms, factories, power plants, refineries, sewage plants, virtually anything that comes out of a pipe is a point source. And non-point is runoff from farms, golf courses, streets, homes, and businesses. For point sources, the first place to go, although there are other places to go, you could go to the US EPA's Toxic Release Inventory. This will give you a pretty good idea. It emerged from the Love Canal evacuation of the 1970s, community right to know laws. You're supposed to be given a general idea of what kind of crap, as Rob says, is being discharged into area streams. It's imperfect. It's highly politicized. It's self-reported industry numbers, but it'll give you a snapshot, not the whole picture, but at least a starting point to go. It's politicized in the sense that chemicals are constantly added and delisted, and industry and the government and environmentalists always challenge over what needs to be reported and to what degree and so forth. Sewage records are a good source too. A lot of communities around, especially older communities like where I'm at, they have overflows with when the sewage networks get overwhelmed from heavy rains. And depending on, unfortunately, it's not a really uniform thing. There's a difference between Ohio and Michigan. We're right on the state line. Michigan, you could find where a sewage overflow occurred online at any point where there's an overflow. For the last several years, I'm going to say maybe 1996, 1997. I mean, you could go online and find out how many gallons, what day, the history of all these overflows. Toledo, and the state of Ohio does not require Toledo to go to any more detail than this. They do release data on where the sewage has been released from different outfalls around the metropolitan area, but they quantify it in time, not in gallons. But still, there's some pretty remarkable statistics there. In a recent story I did, there were numerous instances this summer, which we had an unusually hot and rainy summer where raw sewage was spilling from any one of 31 different outfalls for as long as 24 hours at a time into the Maumee River, which is the major tributary going into Western Lake Erie. But I think instead of just looking, you're only getting a piece of it if you're looking at what crap gets discharged discharged through both point sources and through the runoff of different farms and golf courses and so forth. I think to a large degree, especially today, you need to look to the air. The air and the water are obviously very linked, but especially I mean, you just can't study water pollution without studying air pollution. One good example of that in our part of the country, some of you know where Isle Royale is. It's the least visited national park on purpose, because you have to apply for permits, and it's out in a remote part of Lake Superior, far removed from industry. It's a land of moose and wolves, and it's a very fascinating island that's a kind of a living laboratory in itself. But there's a lake there, Siskiyou Lake, that has too much mercury, and that's all from atmospheric deposition of the fallout from, you know, some of these, and it depends on the contaminant. That's where you need to have some experts describe you on the type of contaminant. You know, mercury and you know, mercury, lead, acid rain, you know, they'll all travel and traverse the globe and for different lengths, and it's really kind of contaminant dependent on how far each one of them will travel. But my point there was that this is a lake that is on a wilderness island far removed from civilization. The fastest you can get to Isle Royale by boat is 3.5 hour ferry in one direction and 7 hours in another, and yet they're having mercury problems on their lake there. Some of the good research sources on the net, the Centers for Disease Control, if you want to be able to defend what you're or confirm or defend or however whatever chemical you're looking at or research more, the Centers for Disease Control has something that's called ToxNet, if you guys have ever heard of that. The beauty of that is, unlike it's a little more over the top in scientific jargon, but the beauty of it is that it's peer reviewed, and unlike a lot of other sites where you may have somebody challenging the toxicity or other things. I mean, this is from the National Institutes of Health, and it's peer-reviewed, and it's about as solid as you can get information from ToxNet. The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry will have information on different pollution up in the Great Lakes area. For years, they were taking blood samples of Great Lakes charter boat captains, people who lived off the fish on a regular basis, to see what kind of contaminants got into the food chain from the water, from the chemical industries and so forth. They were essentially looking at PCBs, if I recall, but that's another outlet. Local university, water labs, of course, enforcement records, courts, prosecutors, offices, EPA. You can pull permits to see who's allowed to discharge what. Doesn't necessarily mean they've got to write a little bit of elbow room into the permit, but hopefully that'll give you an idea of what to look for. Know your region. Who are the major players? Manufacturing. Is it manufacturing? Is it power production? Is it agriculture? In our area, it's a real hybrid of things, from the auto industry to refineries to power production to agriculture, all in a fairly small area. And also look to the soil. There's a lot of secrets locked up in soil. More and more, I know some. A lot of people may have heard these stories about the soil core samples, but you can actually, in Lake Erie right now, stick a tube down there, pull it out, cut it open and slice it like cookie dough, and be able to reference, year from year, what the layer of soil was, and based on the cesium and other elements you'll find, have an idea of where the era of atomic bomb testing was, because even as far as Lake Erie, you had fallout in the lake there. But the reason you want to look to the soil too is because there's a lot of resuspension. And if you're just looking at what's getting put into the lake, you're not really getting a picture of how polluted the lake is because there's a lot of resuspension. They're finding now that there is bacteria that is, it's kind of scary. People always used to think that, at least in our area where, you know, you have a good freeze and bacteria will die off. They're finding, you know, some hardy bacteria that can survive a Lake Erie winter. Bacteria and other pollutants that phosphorus is a good example. You may have this year we had a record phosphorus discharge going into the Maumee River, which feeds Western Lake Erie. We had a record algae outbreak, but also was it wasn't just simply the fact that there was a lot of runoff because there actually was less runoff than there had been in some prior years, but there was more phosphorus, partly because of what was already in the lake, the phosphorus and the sediment getting resuspended.
Where do you find soil records?
Soil and water conservation districts. You can go to them. You also, in our area, we happen to have a water lab, Heidelberg University, that specializes. You know, phosphorus is a big issue. You were mentioning nitrates. Phosphorus is a big issue for us because that's basically what feeds the algae. And we have a laboratory there that specializes in that. But a combination between soil and water conservation districts, EPA, state and federal EPA types. A couple of things I'm going to say. Some good people to know that you might not think of beyond the usual regulators. Try to get to know state and federal spill responders. There are sometimes spill conferences that are held you can get in on. But these are the guys who know, you know, the toxicity, the danger of a lot of the chemicals out there. Sometimes you can, as I have, you can get them to give you, cell phones and get to know them on a personal basis. And they're really kind of, they're the front ones on the scene, the eyes and ears, and they're good people to get to know on the ground level. Coast Guard, firemen, hazmat teams, university researchers, inspectors, like with the National Transportation Safety Board for if you're looking at pipelines, city planners, and even historians. Another piece of advice here is if you're new to this, don't get freaked out by all the abbreviations and acronyms. I mean, there's a whole soup of all these wonkish, reports that are buried with, abbreviations like TMDLs, toxic, or total maximum discharge limits. It's a Clean Water Act, basically the limit of what you're allowed to put in according to your permit, or BACT, Best Available Control Technology, or LAMP, Lakewide Area Management Plan. It's simply a planning document, but there's a lot of jargon to kind of decipher, and just hang with it and make some sense of it, hopefully.
So we've got about 15 minutes left. I want to open it up to questions. I am supposed to admonish you that SEJ members get to ask their questions first. If you just want to pipe up, I'll call on you, and I'm going to repeat your question into the microphone.
I'm curious, a lot of the discussion about Western water rights has to do with water that is on the ground or in the aquifer in the ground, and I'm curious about rain rights, if that's become a problem. I've heard some stories about Arizona and other southern states where folks are trying to, set up rain barrels and so forth that is deemed to be in conflict with the city's own water rights. So I'm curious about that on one hand, and then a second related question would be if you could talk about any conservation measures that have been under discussion in this area.
Yeah, the question is about sort of the conflict between environmentally minded folks who want to set up rain barrel captures at home and rights holders in that watershed, and water conservation specific to Montana.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to take it?
Do you want to summarize what's happening in Colorado?
Oh, well, just in Colorado, they've been trying to do that some up in the mountains, and those folks have been arrested because it interferes with surface rights. And so,
wait, arrested for having a rain barrel?
Using that as their water supply.
The state actually claims it owns the rain?
That water would reach the surface, and by taking that, you're taking from the senior water rights.
There's an exception. There's like several pilot studies, case studies, where they have developments that are actually going to be rainwater harvesting. They just approved the first one sometime this year, I believe. But it's on a really limited basis. There's like a new loophole people can take advantage of.
Does anybody have any sense of where these rain rights are seem to be in conflict and where they're not, and where are these developments occurring?
I don't purport to be an expert on what's happening in Colorado, but I can give you sort of the legal analysis of it. The states inherited ownership of all the water in their jurisdictions. When they became states, they inherited it under federal law. And then states decide the rules for who gets to use water. And most states have said that people can own the right to use surface water and groundwater and haven't really addressed rain. And so in those states, they might say, well, it hasn't become surface or groundwater yet, so you could harvest rain. Montana is a state that says that the state owns all water, including the atmospheric water. And I'm not aware that we've had an issue yet of rain harvesting to such an extent that it is harming the surface water user, but you can imagine a scenario where that takes place, where it's not recharging a water supply and someone has a senior property right, and they're saying you're interfering with it. So I could see the argument. It makes sense. On a de minimis level, you would say, well, one rain barrel isn't going to hurt anything, but if it was a large enough, a significant enough collection effort, it might, and the state might take action in that regard.
How does it make sense, since in a circular fashion, if I don't collect my own water, then I have to use the city's water system, and you got to pipe it up to me?
Mm. So you're talking about, just from like a common sense standpoint. You are assuming the law of common sense.
I've seen this argument done for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Israelis won't allow Palestinians to collect rainwater; they have to buy it. And
mm-hmm.
Water is an issue in that conflict, but that's separate from what's done over here. I don't understand the logic of saying you can't collect rain; you have to have the city collect it, use electricity, spend money to pipe it back up to you.
Have you ever read Donald Worster's Empire? What is it? Empire of Water? Has anybody read
no.
this? It's all about this sort of assumption that's part of the development of the West, is that you will spend money and move water where it needs to go. And then the other principle is that the first person there that developed it first, they have this sacred thing, and if you hurt it, you have to pay for it. So it all, that's why you get all these wonderful economists that come in and say the market can save us all, because you can pay to collect the rain that hurts the senior user, you can pay them, and you get these offset arguments. We'll get the senior user water closer to them so we can collect rainwater over here and not repipe it. But the law does not follow the common sense logic that you're suggesting.
Oh, I'm sorry, forgive me.
No.
It's
a weakness.
Yeah, I'm from Colorado. We have a lot of fracking going on for gas. And I'm just wondering if any of you had any tips. So there's all these people that are saying that their wells are being contaminated, but we're not allowed to know what they're using to frack, so you can't prove that it's from. You don't know what they're putting in, you can't prove that you found it. It's from that. Wondering if anyone had any thoughts on, from a reporter standpoint,
I've never done the question is just about what resources to turn to see what kind of crap is being put into water by hydraulic fracturing.
You can actually collect it yourself and then pay a lab to analyze it. When the World Trade Center came down, I had the reporters for the Journal News who were in the city, we had about 20 of them, had everybody go and buy a box of baggies and then collect samples of the dust and label where you got it from, sitting on a Volvo on 3rd Avenue, whatever, where you got it from. I also had folks by the Hudson River to scoop up some water with all the crap floating in it and label it, bring it to the office. I sent it all to 2 different labs. Now, the EPA put out a statement that the air was fine. I wrote a story that the EPA lies. And here's the data.
So that they won't find anywhere near the
Limit. But you, if you're testing your well, it's your water. Or you can dig a hole in the ground.
No, but you don't know what, you can't correlate. But I just wonder that Wyoming just passed, you know, the rule that companies have to reveal, and I know each company does its own things, but maybe there could be at least some correlating with you can know what's being used in some of the states that are passing transparency laws and possibly use that information to help if you did have results. I don't know how that works, but.
Anybody else
have a
question?
Yeah,
Jeff,
you hard to try this. One of the paradoxes I've been trying to make sense of is that the water conservation, you know, is good for the environment and everything. But a lot of environmentalists protest against that because they say that leads to the sprawl. They would see Sealy Lake as a great thing, but they can't grow because they don't have more water. Eh? And do you guys wrestle with that at all in terms of the growth versus conservation? We don't want people to be more efficient with their water because that will lead to more growth, more sprawl.
The question is about sort of the intersection between water conservation and growth. I'll just tell you what I've seen in San Diego. The choice is not between water conservation and no more growth. It's a choice between water conservation and an expensive new water source like tapping the ocean. And so the environmental community in San Diego, at least, has been fighting seawater desalination and arguing that it's a lot cheaper to save that acre foot of water and to conserve it. The interesting sort of paradox of that is that water agencies have fixed budgets, and their rates that they're charged are based on amortizing debt for building huge projects. And if people save water, they get less revenue. And they have a financial motivation to discourage water conservation. And they would, if they were here, tell you that they're civic-minded people and that they would not do that. But there is not, in San Diego, people save so much water that they're laying off employees. And suddenly, having your lawn, your irrigation off for 7 minutes in the winter, now you can water for 10 minutes if you want. There's that sort of strange paradox just about everywhere.
Also, Jamie, you probably know, a lot of cities like Toledo being a poor city, one thing that they have as an asset is water that is really good water a good water plant. It's become a moneymaker to them, and there are almost, it's almost a self-defeating thing. How far do you go with accommodating, suburban areas because you're encouraging the sprawl outside of the city, but yet you, in the short term, you're eager to sell them water because you're so cash strapped and everything. But also the Great Lakes region, you may know. Just a couple of years ago, signed the Regional Water Compact that you're probably familiar with. One of the key elements of that was water conservation. It was already kind of the akin of closing the barn door when the horse got out because of the NOVA Group's attempt to
ship water to Asia in 1998 that was the impetus for the regional water compact. But all the water experts were telling governors that there needs to be some water conservation measures because their feeling is that this regional water compact would not stand up to a constitutional challenge if push came to shove, because under NAFTA and GATT and so forth, and whether you're going to be able to treat water as a commodity, a lot of that comes down to whether you're essentially hoarding the resource for yourself, or if you're conserving it as doing the best job as a region with water conservation as you can. And clearly, the Great Lakes region hasn't been doing, you know, as good of a job collectively with water conservation as it could, because there's never really been a need for it when you've got, you know, 20% of the world's surface water in your backyard.
There's a great book called Wet Growth. I don't know if anybody's come across it, but it's a compilation of a bunch of articles on the question that you presented. It's called Wet Growth, and the editor is Tony Arnold from University of Florida School of Law. And that, if you're really interested in the subject, I'd recommend that to people. And the other piece I would add is that, to the extent you are conserving water, it's quite possible in the West that water is needed for the ecological reasons that were not considered originally. So even if you have extra water, it doesn't mean you should keep growing, because you might have habitat concerns that you can finally be addressing with the savings.
We got time for one more quick question, and I'll just throw this out. I've got a tip sheet that I've put together for with thoughts and recommendations on investigating local water agencies. So I don't have any copies with me, but I have it on my phone, and I can email it to you. So if you come up afterward and give me a business card, or shoot me an email at rob.davis@voiceofsandiego.org, and I will fire it back to you.
Well, to your point about, well, first, I'm Susan Moran, also living in Colorado, that folks in San Diego, well, that the water price has jumped 75%, and that people are saving so much water, they're putting city employees out of business. So I'm wondering, is there generally, not just in San Diego, but more broadly, an inverse relationship between water prices skyrocketing or increasing at the residential, say, consumer level, and conservation increasing? I mean, does it really make a difference? Because my sense is the price isn't high enough to get most people, households, myself included, to change.
Yeah, I can't tell you off the top of my head what the price elasticity of water is, but it's, and economists will argue about sort of where it falls and what kind of reduction you get for 100% increase, but it should be happening, and there is that sort of correlated relationship, according to what they say.
Well, keep in mind, too, whatever consumers do, and I hate to be kind of a cynic here, is pretty negligible until you start going after agriculture. Agriculture uses, you know, over 80% of all the water to be right off the top. And then you've got industry collectively using only, you know, 10 to 15%, and the, you know, all the people as residential, you know, homes and businesses are, you know, non-industrial type businesses are using, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10%. My point is, I mean, if you, as a country, if we really want to get aggressive about conservation, there's going to have to be something done to try to address the use by agriculture.
Thanks, everybody, for coming, and a round of applause for our panelists.